Welcome to the Bank of Life podcast. I'm your host, James Nethery. This is our Q&A series where I answer questions that you have sent in. Now, this is a special episode because it's our 50th Q&A episode. We produced this series for the last 5.5 years and have had fun doing so. In this particular episode, we have questions that are very common to more thought-provoking questions, and hope you enjoy listening. The next question is, how soon can I withdraw a loan? Well, let's start with a withdrawal. There's a difference between a withdrawal and a loan. A withdrawal is a withdrawal. So you withdraw from the policy values from a life insurance policy. If you have cash value, there should be a withdrawal provision. You can withdraw those cash values up to some point. And then a loan. You know, how soon can I withdraw or loan? A loan is a loan. Withdrawals and loans are different. Withdrawal is from your cash values. A loan is a loan. You're borrowing the life insurance company's money, and you're not taking money out of your cash values. You're collaterally assigning your cash values. So your cash values remain in the policy doing what they're doing, and then you collateralize that cash value with the life insurance company, and you borrow the life insurance company's money. So there's a difference between loan and withdrawal. And how soon can you do that? It depends on company. Every company is a little bit different, but it's in relatively short order. It does not take very long to get a loan or a withdrawal. But I must say that a life insurance company has contractually 6 months if you ask for a loan or withdrawal today, they have contractually 6 months to fulfill that loan request or the withdrawal request. Contractually, they have 6 months before they have to pay a legitimate death benefit as well. And there's a whole history behind why the life insurance companies have 6 months to do that. Now, all of the companies, they just want the loan request in good order. They want the withdrawal request in good order. It does not take long to access capital with a life insurance company. All right. This question is, how long does it take to get set up? I believe you said it varies roughly 45 to 60 days. Is that correct? And if I said 45 to 60 days, that would be from start to finish in underwriting. If you're going to, you've got to qualify for life insurance. You have to make an application to the life insurance company. You know, there's health questions, there's medical underwriting, financial underwriting. They're fully underwritten. So that process, if you decide this, I want to do this, I want to dip my toes in, whatever level, if you want to become your own banker using the infinite banking concept, then you have to have a life insurance policy. So the timeline that he referenced, 45 to 60 days, would be about the timeline it takes to go through underwriting. You need to be educated to the point where, you know, you can make a good decision or feel good about, you know, what you're doing before you go into underwriting, is all I'm saying. The next question, do you use term riders in your policies to boost cash value in the early years? Why or why not? Yes and no. The individual, their situation, what they're doing, what they're trying to do, the construct of, you know, their finances dictates how a policy should be structured and their insurability. There's a lot of factors that go into a design of a policy, in my opinion, and we're pretty particular on structure of a life insurance policy. So the short answer is yes, I do. And there are cases where no, I don't. And there'll be more work in future podcasts on that exact question, to use or not to use term riders. And if I can make any addition there, Nelson Nash did not use term riders in his book, Becoming Your Own Banker. You will not see a term policy in there or a rider. When paying back your loan at a higher rate of interest, plus considering the annual premium due, if you're not careful, couldn't the policy become a MEC, modified endowment contract? Well, yes. So the MEC limit is the MEC limit. The premium that you write to the life insurance company counts toward that MEC limit. Additional interest, what we call the market rate of interest, above what the life insurance company is charging. So if the life insurance company is charging me 5 and I'm repaying at 10, two things are going to happen. One of two things. I'm either going to pay down that loan faster, velocity, right? Or I'm going to have that additional interest paid to my policy. If your policy is constructed to take it, it is still premium to the life insurance company. We're calling it the market rate of interest. It's being set by the third party. If I go borrow money to, it doesn't matter what it's for, real estate, equipment, and the banker wants to charge me 10, or a line of credit, they want to charge me 10, 12, 14, that's the market rate. If I can go to the life insurance company and borrow their money at 5 or a lesser amount, and then I repay the loan to the life insurance company at the market rate of interest, that additional interest, what we're calling interest, is capital to our system, but it's premium to the life insurance company. And that additional interest, premium, absolutely counts against your MEC, or counts toward the MEC limit, the MEC premium limit. The next question is, James, how do you use your policies? Well, currently we have financed a pool, automobiles, a remodeling, house remodeling. We have financed in the past real estate purchases, real estate remodeling, down payments of real estate, medical, dental, deductibles, and medical expenses. We have family vacations, education, we finance taxes. So about every way that you think you can use a policy, you probably can. So we just use them in everyday normal expenses, right? Things that we were going to purchase and finance anyway, we just finance through our life insurance policies. Okay, good question. Thank you. What is direct and non-direct recognition, and how does each impact me? These are compound questions, okay? A direct recognition company, the short of it is they directly recognize an outstanding loan. They do not pay a full dividend, or they either pay no dividend or a reduced dividend on the loan balance that's outstanding. And I'm just say they directly recognize an outstanding loan, therefore they're going to reduce or not pay a dividend on that loan balance that's outstanding. A non-direct recognition company does not directly recognize an outstanding loan. They pay the dividend whether there is a loan outstanding or not. Now, I know in the big wide world of the infinite banking concept that agents and companies say, oh, it doesn't matter. Okay. Or you can make up for it. You know, if I have a large outstanding loan and I get a reduced dividend, I can make that up by repaying the loan at a higher interest rate when the company's charging me. Well, yeah, well, that would make up for it. But the bottom line, they're still not paying me a dividend on an outstanding loan. Does it make a difference? How is it going to affect me? Well, let's say that I get into a passive income in retirement. I can either withdraw my cash values, right? I can either withdraw cash values from the life insurance policy, or I can collateralize the cash values and borrow the insurance company's money using the cash values collateral. Now, let's say that I'm doing that. And the future is unknown. I don't know what I'm going to do, and I don't know what you're going to do. I mean, I hope it's all good and successful and healthy. But if I'm in the future taking passive income through collateralization, I am borrowing the life insurance company's money collateralized with my cash values. I want a dividend. So I want a non-direct recognition company. Me personally. And that's what I want my clients to own. Non-direct recognition. But what if the life insurance company goes bankrupt or something? Listen, give me. Life insurance companies cannot go bankrupt. They can go into receivership. They are regulated by the states. Minimum standards of regulations are actually, they're regulated by the states. But, you know, Uncle Sam, the federal government, has his hand in everything as well. So he sets some standards. But all of the states comply and go above the minimum standards of the federal requirements. And so here's what happens if a life insurance company who are regulated by the states. If a state insurance regulator shows up and says you don't have enough capital reserves on hand to meet future obligations, they're going to give them a time period to accumulate capital to meet the future obligations, and the life insurance company is either going to do that or they're not going to do that. If they do that, fine. If they do not do that, then there one or two things are going to happen. They're going to step in, the state will step in and place them into receivership, and they will either manage them back to health or they will liquidate them. If they liquidate them, every other legal reserve life insurance company that's doing business in that state has to step in and guarantee those contracts. Now you think about that. What other industry, any other industry in the world, you tell me what other industry, any industry in the world, is going to potentially have to stand good for their competitors? None. Okay. Why does Dave Ramsey say it's rubbish? Because we would pay high fees. So who's telling the truth? You know, I'm being very straightforward and truthful and honest. I can't speak for Dave Ramsey. I can see what Dave Ramsey has done over the last 30 years. And he sells an awful lot of advertising, right? Yes, he does. And he sells an awful lot of curriculum in the churches, right? And they pose in the churches as financial education. Well, look, most of the preachers are begging for money. And it, I think it's sold to the churches like, oh, your people are in debt. No kidding. No kidding. You're born into a debt slave construct. No kidding. The debtor is always servant to the lender. No kidding. You want to get out of debt? No kidding. Good. Get out of debt. And you can't get out of debt fast enough. So, but Dave Ramsey has an agenda. He sells advertising. Right, he sells curriculum, and it's an easy sell into the church. The people are in the church begging for money. They're afraid that their people aren't going to tithe or whatever. And my God, if you'll just preach the truth, they will come. I digress. And I'm a Christian. Listen, I'm not picking on, you know, I don't even have to say all that. You know, if you'll preach the truth, they'll come, preacher. What is flawed with the 1090 or the 9010? A lot, an awful lot. And it's like, there's so much flawed with that, I can't really cover it in a podcast or in a short episode, especially in a Q&A. This question is based on the 9010 or the 1090 is a percentage of premium applied to the base and a percentage of the premium applied to the PUA. So the 1090 is promoted as a one size fits all. That's wrong. But it's also like 10% premium being paid to the base, and it's so mischaracterized. I've heard stupid things like, oh, this buys the life insurance and the other buys cash. So the 1090 is a percentage of premium applied to the base, 10%, little as possible, and then 90% applied to the PUA. And so there are several things wrong with that. It eats up a lot of insurability, it limits the premium that you can pay in the future years, and it's fragile, and it's the longer you go, the more problematic that it becomes. That is not where you start to design a policy. So when there's a blanket statement that you should pay a 1090 premium or buy a policy that's built that way, it's wrong, they're wrong. And if you watch all those videos and come to the conclusion that that's correct, you're wrong. Now, and even if they come from the premise that, oh, 60-40, quote unquote, 60 to the PUA, 40 to the base is what Nelson did, and so this is so much better because you have more cash in year one. It's all hogwash. Is that the end of the world? No, in certain circumstances, it's not as bad as in other circumstances. But if 1090 is good, Then you can also go 98% to the PUA and 2% to the base. Don't believe that, oh, this company only goes up to that limit, and so therefore that's why we do that. That's wrong. There are companies out there, substantial, stable, strong companies, that will allow you to pay 98% to the PUA and 2% to the base. Now, if that's good, and it's not, but if it were, why don't you just go purchase tax-free municipal bonds and buy a 30-year term policy, right? It's like, that comes from an idea of scarcity and ignorance, okay? And then ease. If I say to you that this is the only way to do something and everything else is wrong, it's like, then this applies to everybody. What is a maximum amount that I can put in initially or at one time? He continues, I do believe you told me the amount would vary, but there was a once a year lump sum amount that is available. Is that correct? Look, the premium to the life insurance company is paid either annually, monthly, semi-annually, or quarterly. And the structure is the structure when you have an infinite banking structure. To a life insurance policy, there's at least two primary components of that policy structure. One is the base whole life policy that has a premium. And then there is a PUA or a paid up additions rider. It's a rider to the whole life policy, but it's still premium. And the companies vary. They even call their paid up edition riders various names, but then they also have varying allowances or company practices of how much can you put a lot of premium into a policy in year one and reduce the premium in year two? Yes, that's possible. So can I put additional money into the paid up editions? Yes, if the policy is structured to take it. How often can you do that? It depends on the company. Some companies you have to pay the PUA premium on the anniversary, and some allow premium payments to the PUA throughout the year. So that's kind of a variable by company. Okay, and then what is a maximum amount that I can pay initially at one time? You know, the amount of premium that you can even pay is addressed with the financial underwriting of a life insurance policy. You know, we are all limited. We can only pay a certain percentage of our gross annual income, or a particular factor if we're asset heavy and don't have income. You know, we can pay a multiple of our net worth in premium, but we're also limited on the total death benefit that one can have in force on their life. So those are two limits. And then once you determine a premium that you want to pay, then we have to deal with the modified endowment contract guidelines, MEC. But so I hope I answered your question. What does converting some of my term actually do to my existing policy? Well, if you have an existing term, or if you have an existing policy with a term rider on it, it was probably put on there by design to raise the death benefit, which raises the MEC, modified endowment contract premium limit. So if you convert that, you have to be aware of what it does to your existing policy. Does it drop the death benefit so low that it can cause a MEC in the future? Other than that issue, what does it do to your existing whole life policy? It probably limits what you can pay in premium in the future years. Could you do a podcast or YouTube video interviewing someone who has had those policies for more than 30 years? Nobody ever does this, and I would love to get some real life feedback on how these policies work for a person over the long term. Ryan. Listen, yes, we have. We've had Paul Cleveland as a guest. He's a PhD economist out of Birmingham Southern, and he was a client of Nelson Nash himself. And so I don't know if he's at the 30-year mark, but very close to it. And then I don't personally have any clients that have practiced this concept for 30 years. I discovered it 16 years ago. So I don't have any clients that go beyond 16 years. And and I think I said it earlier, but when you find somebody that has practiced this over a long period of time, and I believe it is important for them to share, and it's important for them, for you to hear them when you have the opportunity. But they're just confirming what Nelson said was possible. When you practice the infinite banking concept, you can become your own banker. And it looks different for everybody. And just as important as listening to people that have practiced this for 5, 10, 8, 12, 15 years or longer, just as important as important as they are, that, you know, I want to say that's very important or powerful or beneficial to listen to somebody who's practiced this over a long period of time. But just as important is to hear the people that are newly exposed to this idea and that have gone through all the mental gymnastics and have determined that this makes sense for them, and they paid a premium. And where did they come up with the premium? How did they justify that? What are their intentions? What are they going to do? That's extremely important as well. The new person and the older person, the longtime practitioner. So, short answer is we're bringing them on, you know, 8, 9, 10 year clients. Paul Cleveland, I don't know how long he's been doing it, but well over 20 years. So, yours truly has been doing it for 16 years. What dictates my insurability? Well, everybody has a limit on insurability. We can all only own so much death benefit from all sources. And so what dictates that is my age and income, or my net worth. So if I'm 50 and I have $100,000 in income, at 50, I can maybe have 20 times my income in total death benefit. So if I earn $100,000, I can have $2 million in death benefits. So that's just rough, but it's fairly accurate. So it's based on age and income. The older I get, the smaller the factor is. So if I'm 65, I can have 10 times my income. If I'm 20, I can have 30 times my income. And then there's some additional caveats to that. Or I can have 1 times my net worth. Maybe I don't have an income, but I'm worth $5 million. Then I can have $5 million in death benefit. This is a statement, which I appreciate greatly, Greg. The peace of mind, the emotional peace that life insurance provides beyond the cash value, leverage, the investments, etc., is wonderful. The death benefit has so much value. I appreciate you saying that greatly, Greg. I completely agree. The death benefit is greatly diminished in the footprint of the infinite banking world, right? And I understand that we're building policies to accumulate cash value. You cannot discount the death benefit. Life insurance doesn't come any other way. You cannot buy life insurance without a death benefit. Now, let's think this through. Life insurance policies today are built upon a hypothetical 120-year life expectancy. The cash value must equal the face amount at age 120. Or 121, at the end of 120 years of life, 121. The cash value must equal the face amount. Okay. So, do you want a small death benefit or a large death benefit? Knowing full well, the further out into the future you go, the cash value is rising every day to equal the increasing death benefit at age 121. Okay. Now, if I'm building cash, no question we structure policies for cash value. No question. And that is what you can collateralize. You're borrowing against the cash value. The death benefit is collateralizing the outstanding loan, which will compound if you don't pay the interest, right? And so you should be an honest banker and repay your loans with the market rate of interest. And that's a whole nother conversation. But if the life insurance company is going to charge you 5, 6, or 8%, and the third party lender, and I understand you can get a 30-year mortgage today for 3%, I get it. But tell me your credit cards at 3%. How many of those do you have? Zero, none, unless you have, you know, a limited come on gimmick offering, you know, the first 12 months, 0% financing. Perfect, right? And you know as well as I do, there's no such thing as 0% interest. The cost of financing is built into the purchase. Okay. I'm just saying the death benefit collateralizes the outstanding loan. Now, what happens if you practice this idea of leveraging every dollar in cash value or loan value that you have, and you're paying the minimal premium as possible? Pretty soon, you're only going to be paying interest only because you can. And then pretty soon, that thinking will take you right down the road of stealing peas. I'm not going to make a loan repayment. We're going to let that loan just compound, and they'll do beautifully. They'll compound a long time without a loan repayment. But sometime in the future, the odds of that policy collapsing, they're very high. Okay, there's lots of illustrations out in the infinite banking world that doesn't show a loan repayment. It looks beautiful on an illustration. And some of them, if you just continue to do the work and the research on the illustrations, if they lived, these individuals lived as long as Nelson, the policy's going to collapse because the loan grew out of control. Right, and you didn't sell the business, or this big investment idea didn't pan out the way you expected, right? Then what happens? If the loan out compounds the cash value, that loan out compounds a death benefit, that policy is going to lapse. In the year that it lapses, that's a taxable event to the owner. All right, so let's go out 30 years and have $1 million tax bill in a given year. Yeah, that might have been a little too much on the answer, but I'm just sharing. Thank you for your comment, Greg. You want an adequate death benefit for you and your family, and you want an adequate premium for you and your family, which will produce adequate cash values for you and your family. And don't buy into this idea that everything is a one-size-fits-all. It is not. Your finances are not your neighbor's finances, or not my finances, and my finances are not your finances, right? So we're all different, and thank God. Right. Every life insurance policy should be different, unless you're twins, and not even paternal twins. And this question, did you make a video explaining the premiums and PUA and why it takes a few years of losing money up front? Okay, well, let me address that. And I think we've talked about that in several podcasts, but you're not losing money. There is a loss of liquidity for a time period. So if I pay a premium, and if I paid in $10,000, I only have access to $6,000, $7,000, or $8,000, whatever it is in the first year, and I quit, that is a loss. There's no question. If I continue that policy and I continue making premium payments, there's some point in time in the future that my total cumulative premium payments in is going to equal and then exceed the total cumulative cash value. So there is a loss of liquidity in the early years of a life insurance policy. He goes on in that question with this statement, because every now and then I get hesitant paying the PUA. Well, and I think that's completely natural. If you buy a life insurance policy, it comes with a premium. The premium looks like an obligation, and it is. Part of it is an obligation. However, all of the liquidity in a life insurance policy in the early years is into the PUA, the paid up additions rider. So remember Nelson's four fundamental rules. Number one, think long range. Number two, don't be afraid to capitalize, i.e. do not be afraid to pay a premium. All right. And then number three is don't steal the peas. A loan should not be made without a loan repayment schedule or method. All right, so you just shouldn't make a loan without a plan to make a loan repayment. Hi, James. I have a question. Why aren't you advising people to do Velocity Banking or Infinite Banking using their 401k funds? That is free from credit approvals. You pay yourself back. You can borrow a chunk a year, and you can pay it back over 5+ years. Thanks. Listen, when you practice the infinite banking concept correctly,
with policies structured correctly, with legitimate life insurance companies, two things are always happening. You are always putting velocity to your money, and you are always taking advantage of arbitrage. Arbitrage and velocity, these are not new things that, you know, just because some people created, you know, velocity banking or infinite banking using your 401k. Have you read Nelson's book, Becoming Your Own Banker? Just because you can borrow against an asset doesn't mean you're practicing the infinite banking concept. Who's controlling that loan when you borrow money from your 401k? 50% is the limit, up to $50,000. All right. So don't tell me can you borrow against your 401k? Yes, of course you can. But there's a lot of things going on with the 401k that just because you can borrow against it doesn't mean you want to. So I don't advise people unless they're my clients. Okay. So, but thanks for the comment. I appreciate it. Quick question. Happy Thanksgiving. Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving to you. Merry Christmas. Feliz Navidad. Lilike, Kalike Maka. Let's see. I listen to your podcast weekly when I do the yard, and it's oh so good. Thank you. At about the 22nd minute mark, you said you should have wrote a premium check first by paying the family member, and I've had the same epiphany. But then my old self retorts back saying you would have to pay it back. So it's like you have to come up with $2 for every one that you take or borrow, one to pay the premium, and then borrow another dollar to pay it down. What principle am I missing here? I get brain damage every time I think about it. Could you share in an episode sometime, use an example like a car, tax payment, something that doesn't have a cash flow? Thanks for making my summer yard work a breeze. Well, thank you, Wing, for sharing and asking that question. And I want to clarify, when I spoke of Uncle Guido, I'm pretty sure that I was out in the parking lot. My dad was in a facility on hospice. It was in April. And I'm outside writing a check to Uncle Guido, the IRS. I was writing a check to Uncle Guido. And so I love this question because I get to clarify who Uncle Guido is. And it dawned on me, and I was about 4 or 5 years into practicing the infinite banking concept. I had already financed credit cards, some dental, some medical deductibles, some automobiles, and things like that. And here, I thought that, I mean, I'm knocking it out of the park, right? And I'm writing a check to Uncle Guido that could choke a mule. And it dawned on me that it's like, oh my gosh, this should have been a premium payment first. And I'm 4 or 5 years into it. I had the opportunity to read the book. I've talked about it. I spent a lot of time with Nelson. And I thought I was sharper than that. And I've equated it many times to, you know, a man shaving his face every day for 4 or 5 years. Then all of a sudden, in the fourth or fifth year, you see the nose on your face. It was there the whole time and you didn't see it. So it was an epiphany for me. And it's very natural to think that, okay, I've got to pay a premium. Yep. And then when I borrow, I have to make a loan repayment. Yep. So you should be saving money somewhere. You should be accumulating money for the future. Where is that? I don't know. But you should consider maybe that cash flow, that savings, that cash flow should be a life insurance premium so I can build capital because I'm going to use it in the future, right? Now, if I have access to that capital contractually, I can collateralize that cash value. That's no different than I'm saving for retirement with one cash flow, and then I go buy a car with another cash flow. And then I go buy a house, I go pay for education, college, medical deductibles, or whatever, credit cards. There's two cash flows anyway. You're saving money somewhere. If you're not, you should be. And if you can't, then it's a moot point. If you cannot save money, if you do not have the discipline to save money, this is not going to help you. Okay? So you should have the discipline to save money. That's one cash flow. Now, if you're going to buy a car or everything that you purchase, you're going to finance. And I'm not talking about running grocery money through your life insurance policy, and neither did Nelson. Okay? So if I go buy a car, I'm going to borrow money from the third-party lender to finance that car, and then they're going to require the loan repayment. Another cash flow. All right, so there's always two cash flows, and I get it. The carnal mind's like, oh my gosh, I can't do that. There's no smoke and mirrors here. Now, if I get into a bind, right, I can lower a premium or I can lower a loan repayment because I control that. Well, if I'm not controlling the banking function and I'm putting money up somewhere in savings and I'm financing something, the third-party lender's dictating to me what my loan repayment is. You know, they're not... I don't have the ability to say, oh, I'm going to skip payments for six. I'm going to make interest-only payments for a year, right? They're going to tell me how I'm going to pay it back and when I'm going to pay it back, right? So then it would force me to, I've got to reduce my savings cash flow, right? Because the lender, the third-party lender has more priority. Why? Because they're controlling the banking function. So I digress a little, but we're talking about two cash flows. And if your policy is structured correctly, or you have a greater understanding from just a basic understanding of the infinite banking concept, I mean, if you work with a competent advisor or agent, you will be able to maintain control of your policies and your loans. And if not, you know, whomever you're working with is either not competent or you don't have discipline or both. Okay. All right, so you're not missing anything here. You're just working through the paradigm shift in thinking that's required, and it's okay. But yes, I can go further into these examples of automobile payments and taxes in the future. We're working on them currently. We've been working on them. Don't want to throw carrots out there, but we're still in the first quarter of 2021. We're beta testing now our client only access. So in short order, it's going to be up and ready to go. And you, sir, are a client. So you're going to have access to these things that you ask about. So thank you. Kind of a statement and a question. Okay. Thank you for all that you have done and continue to do for the uneducated about IBC. Thank you for saying that. I thoroughly enjoy listening each week, and I find myself re-listening to whole or parts of previous episodes and finding awareness continuously improving. I appreciate that. Okay. I have a policy through a Canadian practitioner, and when asked about IBC by someone who is curious but non-committal, what is your favorite IBC asset to start with? Thanks, Agent 001, and kind regards to Great Dane and Lucy's dad. I appreciate that. And my encouragement is for people to read Nelson's books. Number one, Becoming Your Own Banker. And then number two, Building Your Warehouse of Wealth. If someone reads those books and they're not interested in learning more or implementing it, you know, perfect. If they are, you know, then we can have a conversation. But I don't do anything but promote the idea that you can become your own banker. And I do it with Nelson's books and his 6.5-hour DVD series that is available at NNI and through our website as well. This question, what happens if the dollar collapses? What would insurance companies do? Well, what would happen if the dollar collapses? Well, let's see, the dollar collapses. Look, economy is still going to exist among men, period. So if the dollar collapses or any other currency collapses, it's going to be replaced with some other form of currency. So every asset that you have currently, if you're in the U.S., is valued in dollars. Every asset that you have, if the dollar collapses, it's going to be revalued with a new currency. Life insurance is the same way. And I can't control that. But what I can control is what I'm doing with the cash values. Okay. So, and most of the time, these upheavals happen suddenly. But, you know, we can pay attention and see generally what's going on and what direction we're going in the big wide world. So, if I think something tragic is going to happen, I could personally go borrow against the life insurance policies and buy gold, silver, cryptocurrencies, water filters, tobacco, whiskey, ivermectin, you know, antibiotics, automobiles, you know, engines that don't run on digital chips. I can do whatever I want. I could go buy cows. I can do whatever it is I want. Okay. And so if the dollar collapses, there's going to be some form of currency or valuation, some kind of a medium of exchange that we're all going to use. And then the other question, I mean, it wasn't asked here. The other question is, what if the markets collapse? Well, what if they collapse? You know, you can't control that either. Maybe I would want to have water filters, tobacco, whiskey, cigarettes. And I don't even smoke, although I do enjoy a good cigar every now and then. So I hope that helps. This question is, how do you compensate for inflation? It's a very good question. Inflation is one of the greatest headwinds that we all face concerning our money. And you compensate for inflation using your God-given abilities and talents, right? When it comes to the infinite banking concept, we're putting high premium into high cash value, properly structured dividend paying life insurance policy. So you're creating a pool of capital from which to operate from. You know, you have to do a good job with the opportunities that you engage with. That opportunity must provide a greater value in the future and or a cash flow. That greater value in the future and or the cash flow should be part of the way you compensate for inflation. Using your God-given abilities and talents, putting your capital to work with legitimate, bona fide, vetted opportunities. And then I talk about life insurance being the best hedge against inflation when it comes to a cash flow. And what I specifically mean by that, if I pay a premium into a policy, there's going to be a greater increase in cash value over time. Well, if that premium is, and it is, a cash flow in. If I borrow against that policy, that's a cash flow out. All right, so that there is a greater increase in value that I can collateralize compared to the premium that I paid. The further out you go on a life insurance policy, the greater that is and the better that it looks. Now, in this answer, I'm not compensating for that outstanding loan. That has to be taken into consideration as well. You have to be able to manage that outstanding loan if you're only using life insurance as a cash flow basis, which that is not where you start with life insurance, on a cash flow basis. Get as much money in as possible and take as much money out as possible. However, that's how you compensate for inflation, using your God-given abilities and talents, vetting the opportunities. And that's one thing that the infinite banking concept allows or helps, is it helps you, the owner, to properly judge and classify opportunities, because your cash does very well in life insurance as it is. If you look at a life insurance policy, the premium in, cash flow in, the loan available out on an annual cash flow basis, it's staggering, very impressive when it's done correctly. And this question, James, I have enjoyed listening to you and thank you for the work that you are doing. Thank you for recognizing that, and you are welcome. I appreciate you. I appreciate the comment. Okay. My question is, how will the infinite banking concept be affected by our society moving into a cashless system and a possible mark of the beast situation regarding clients' access to funds? Great question, Joel. And listen, the end times are coming. All right. I mean, I believe in Revelations, the silver and gold is going to be worthless, right? And the gold is going to be cast into the streets. Until that happens, right, everything that you do in the United States is numerated in U.S. dollars. Look, this idea that cash is trash and that, you know, you get rid of the dollar is hogwash. The dollar is being hoarded around the world right now. And here we are in September of 2020. Well, why is that? The dollar is a worthless paper IOU. We all know that. Let's move beyond that. But the dollar represents the United States economy, the greatest economy man has ever put together on the face of this earth. The cashless society is almost here anyway. About 90 to 95% of our transactions are digital. That means, you know, 5 to 10% of our currency is physical. So we're almost there. And what happens? Life insurance is repriced with every other asset that's numerated in the U.S. dollar. And at the end of the day, you know, I can only control some of that. I can't control really any of that. What I can control are my cash flows. James, how does crypto and the rapture fit into IBC? Well, you know, the rapture is debatable, isn't it? Right. And then everybody has an opinion on cryptocurrency. So my opinion is this, that these events are in the future, right? If they happen or they don't happen, rapture, right? And the cryptocurrencies, I think Jordan Anderson and I just had a podcast released and he brought that up. We've talked about that. I think cryptocurrency is a psyop. But I think there's a lot of people making money and losing money in the arena of cryptocurrencies. Whatever you're going to do between now and the end of the world, between now and the end of the currency, between now and the economy collapsing, and I'm not saying any of those are happening, between now and whatever happens in the future, somebody's performing the banking function in your life and they're making a profit from it. My encouragement is for you to become your own banker, right? And you be profitable by being your own banker. So Nelson used to say everybody should be in two businesses. One, whatever it is you do for a living. And two, you should finance whatever it is you do for a living. Now, if you're an all-American, you know, family, mom, dad, single, whatever, it doesn't matter. You're not in business per se, right? You're still financing every major purchase that you enjoy, right? So you can become your own banker and finance with the infinite banking concept every major purchase that you're going to make between now and whatever happens in the future. So I hope that answers your question, young man. Do you gentlemen own any gold? And by the way, your videos are the best videos anyone can stumble upon YouTube. Thanks for sharing your knowledge. Seriously. Well, thank you, Mr. Daly. I happen to own gold. I like gold. I like precious metals and real property. And Mr. Griggs, we'll let him answer that for himself. Can you do a podcast on the new tax changes regarding the guaranteed growth in cash value? Kind of referencing earlier and the earlier question of, you know, the bottom line is that interest rate has changed that the life insurance companies can use to calculate a MEC or the net single premium of a life insurance policy. Maybe I can have somebody on in the underwriting world or the actuary world that can speak more to that. At the end of the day, I believe, and time will tell, right, these policies, I think they have to be in existence by the end of this year, I believe, 2021, and I should get clarity on that date before I say it. But there is a time in which the companies must comply, and I think that it's going to require less death benefit to avoid a MEC. And then in the industry, people are concerned about the cash values being less than what they are now. And there's also concern, and I'm pretty sure that the universal life policies are just going to receive more challenges. Okay. This question, Mike asks, James, I see the Great Dane painting behind you. That would be over my left shoulder, right? The right of your screen. I can't make out what's on the picture over your right shoulder, though. What is it? Well, that is a creation of Andrew, our AV ninja, and he created that picture of Nelson and I. It's a great work. Andrew did a great job of that. I really like it. He did an outstanding job. So that's Nelson Nash and myself. And maybe Andrew can put that up on the screen for you to be able to see that. The Great Dane is not actually a painting of our Great Dane, my wife and I, or Ryan Griggs. Ryan got himself a Great Dane because They're so lovable, the Great Danes. Anyway, my wife had that one created. Hey, James, enjoy all of the podcast. Thank you. Many quote-unquote older retirees have most of their wealth tied up in their home, mostly paid for. What is the wisest way to transfer that home equity to a properly structured dividend-paying whole life insurance policy for infinite banking? Should they consider a HELOC, then pay it off with policy loans they also pay back? Thanks and warmest regards. Well, thanks for the question and the kind words, David. And, you know, most all of America has the majority of their wealth either in a qualified retirement plan and or their home, their primary place of residence. And the real estate is just not liquid. You know, in an up market like today, yeah, it's very liquid, right? But for you to access that equity, you have to go to the third party lender, right? A HELOC, you're going to a third party lender. Can you do that? Sure, you can do that. What is the best way? If a situation calls for the access of the equity in the home. And I'm not, just because we own an asset and we have equity in it, doesn't mean we want to extract the equity, right? But if that were to be the case, then a HELOC is as good as any other loan, right? I mean, I personally have many times that I prefer 30-year fixed mortgages. And I've done many cash out refinances. Cash out, I refinance, cash out, pay a PUA premium all day long, every day. So remember the golden rule, right? He who has the gold makes the rules. The banker can do whatever he wants. So a HELOC is probably better than, in my opinion, a 30-year, 15-year mortgage. At the end of the day, I encourage people to maintain control of their leverage. Never a problem until there's a problem. But when there's a problem, and generally these problems occur suddenly, and you're over leveraged, then assets start swapping hands. So in an older person that has the majority of their wealth tied up in their primary place of residence, I don't know if that's the wisest idea to extract all of that equity and pay a life insurance premium. All right? Okay. I hope that helps, sir, David. Thank you for listening. If you have a question that you would like answered, email me at james@bankingwithlife.com. Thank you for listening. Have a great day, and we'll see you next time.